My wife pointed out, as usual, when I got back, that the program said I was talking about euthanasia yesterday. I actually prefer to do abortion and link conscience and euthanasia rather than abortion. There are conscience issues in abortion, of course, but most of us in medicine could look at the people who had to deal with them. They didn't hit us. Euthanasia brings it home to everyone pretty well. Well, not everyone. There's still some places where you can hide. Not loud enough. Okay, sorry. Let's put this up here. It's not on yet. Yet? No? Hello?
The speakers are off.
Ah. Good. Somebody who knows which button to press. Is that working now? Sounds a little bit as though it is to me. Better or not?
Not yet.
Not yet. We're missing something else. Not yet. It sounds as though it's got a slight... Is that working? No. Let's just see whether it's come out along here. Whoops, yep. Something happened. I don't know where it was. Is that it? It's on there? Well, something happened when I went this, but that's probably just dragging on. Stick it out. Well, yeah, when it's going, you can get it right, but that's pretty close. It ought to pick it up all right there. I wonder, when I went that way, following the cable, whether there's something in the cable somewhere. Don't know which one it goes to. Yeah. There's a plug there that's not working properly. Is that working now? Well done. I don't know which one it was that did it, but you got to stay there all holding the cable. Okay. I prefer to do conscience rites and euthanasia because euthanasia has brought conscience rites to the fore more than abortion did. Difficult book to read, those of you who like reading serious stuff that really make you think, is O'Donovan's Resurrection and the Moral Order. It's not an easy book to read, but it is full of real wealth. In particular, explaining something that always intrigued me is why medical care as we understand it didn't even show any vestiges of appearing in practice until after Christ. Except for this little amazing freak in the 5th, 6th century BC when the physicians on the island of Kos understood that trust was central to medicine. I think that's what they did. And one of the things that we need to talk about a lot is what generates trust. Trust is, well, in Robert Fogel's view, the limiting commodity for the survival and flourishing of the Western world. There isn't enough of it. And I would tell graduate students going to conferences, don't listen to too much at the conference, talk to people. Because particularly at the poster sessions, for instance, only 1 in 16 posters makes it to a publication. So unless you're smart enough to know which the one is, you're reading non-peer-reviewed material. Peer review is by no means perfect, but it's a start. But what you can do is talk to the people who are working in your area and find out what sort of people they are. Talking about families and those kinds of things. And you will find over the years that's incredibly valuable information, particularly if you're doing medicine, because you cover such a wide range. Now, I had an academic area of membrane transport where I actually had the pleasure of meeting virtually everybody in the top echelon that mattered. And some of them I did not trust an inch. And in subsequent years, I found out why. There were others, I didn't always like them, and they didn't always like me, but we had some respect for one another, and that worked over years. And of course, you need that in medicine, because evidence-based medicine doesn't work. Given my applied area, nutrition in medicine, I could see a neonate and an 80-year-old on the same day. Now, there's no way anyone can cover all that ground. Thank God for the invention of computers and Venn diagrams. What a brilliant combination that is. You know, you can go there and put in three main things that you're concerned about, and you've still got N million to go through. And then you say, okay, let's look at the best journals. And then you look for some authors. And if you know a little bit in the area, you get down to a manageable number very quickly. Without computers and the Venn diagram, we'd have died under a sea of paper. We wouldn't be able to tell one thing from another. It's not a perfect system by any means. So you do need, as you know, to have a referral practice, you must trust the people you're referring to. And when somebody says to me, which I've heard more than once now in medical school, I don't trust anyone in this medical school, how can you possibly do medicine? You can't. You can't know it all. You'll get it wrong. And the fact that so often certain of our bits of medicine are more prone to this than others, you all remember teachers who scolded you for not knowing things. That's ridiculous to students. The first time I got a group to teach bedside, I wouldn't tell them what I wanted from them. They discovered it as I stretched the rounds out and said, you can go now, you've done well enough. And eventually, the proud ones realized that everybody who said, I don't know, was dismissed. But those who wouldn't say, I don't know, were not dismissed. Of course, you could only do that once. They knew then that one of the most important things is to be able to say, I don't know, isn't it? Certainly, your residents and your juniors, you can sleep at night if you know they know how to say, I don't know. You can't if they think they know it all. Important. I had on one occasion the wonderful privilege of diagnosing the last case of spontaneous smallpox in Europe. And it was very good that I was on that night, because the boss, who would have to come out, because the whole public health system on this, it was a wonderful thing to watch. It worked perfectly. I used to do one night on call because I like seeing patients at first, what do you call it, the first time they get into hospital anyway. And we were close to London Airport, so you might get something interesting. But on this occasion, it was a doctor called and said, I've got a little girl from an Indian family, and it's an overcrowded family, but she's got bad chicken pox. Can you take her in? We had a proper ID set up with plenty of space. So I said, sure, send her in. Unfortunately, it was an old fever hospital originally, so it had a receiving room which did not connect to the hospital, which was very wise. It opened out into a courtyard. So that's where the patients were sent. They didn't go to the general outpatients or emerge. They went to this receiving room, the ID receiving room. That night would have been, the next 48 hours would have been horrendous if that hadn't been in place. Now, I had to teach medical students every 6 weeks how to make the distinction between smallpox and chickenpox. Very easy to make. You only have to have the thought and the job's done. But the implications are so important that about a dozen doctors in Britain at that stage were allowed to press the button to say, yes, this is smallpox. They're all within driving distance, so the country was covered. You know. My boss was one of them. The good part of their duties was they got a trip to India every 5 years, because that's where they knew they could show them smallpox and they could make sure they're up to date, although they were anyway. But Harold was a super doc, but he was sick. He'd got really bad gastroenteritis. And I called him and said, "Harold, I've got a case of smallpox." And he said, "It can't be, John." I said, "It is." He said, "I'm glad it's you on." Because he said this a little later when he came, somewhat groggy, came in booted, gowned, you know, and we started the whole process. But he said, "I might have persuaded the juniors that it was Stevens-Johnson syndrome." And if he had done that, the child would have gone to the ward, the whole place would have been closed down, and there would have been deaths. But this system, set in place by the Victorians, was amazing. He knew exactly what happened. So there was one technician at the National Public Health Laboratories in London who was on call, who could do the rapid smallpox analysis. Always. Hadn't done it for 10 years. But we had the answer in 3 hours. The ambulance service used it as an excuse to keep a lovely old Daimler ambulance, which was only used for the Queen and for smallpox. but that turned up with a hyperimmune crew. The funniest bit was the very last bit, because smallpox is inactivated by water. So the only people who had seen this child in the hospital were me and the nurse in the receiving room. And the first thing I'd done when I got in there, it took about 30 seconds to realize, it was locked the door. But now we had to go out, but without our clothes, because they had to be left there. So two naked medical people had to run across the courtyard to the nearest shower. Yeah. It would not have been a laughing matter, however, had Harold not respected my opinion at that point. And we all have juniors that we don't. Trust is so vital to what happens. It affected Sally's life as well, yeah. She was pregnant. So I called her and said, "Drop me some clean clothes and go to your dad for a couple of weeks." Because, well, not that long, but I was out of date on my vaccination, so I had four that night. I wasn't worried, because one of the wonders of God's grace is that smallpox has a very narrow incubation time. It's 11 to 13 days. And the vaccine takes in 5 days. So you've got an 8-day window, which is very important in epidemics. That's why we can close them down nowadays if we're good. But Sally was pregnant, so I said, "You better go until I know I've not got smallpox." So that was the last bit of the story. But lovely to see that kind of thing could grow in the world. Now it's disappearing again, isn't it? I mean, we're so close to controlling smallpox, and who's stopping it happening? Radical Muslim imams, who say it's really an attempt to diminish our fertility. Because everybody's into conspiracy theory now, aren't they? Frightening. The only places where it's still there are, it's dangerous to be a vaccinator. They get murdered. Astonishing. So this area of life, what we believe, O'Donovan writes about how our world developed its moral order following the resurrection, and why it couldn't really happen before the resurrection. He's a brilliant scholar. The problem is, he's too brilliant at times for most of us. I mean, I have never read the whole of Resurrection and Moral Order, and I've read parts of it many times, and I get further every time. He points out, he says, the Christian community has always been a meta-ethical community. Moral theology must be present in Christian ethics for historical reasons. So once our ethics becomes diminished in that way, when it's no longer Christian ethics, it will not function in the way that it did before. Because you and I know that our problem is not so much with knowing what is good and what is evil, but in the doing thereof, the good, and not doing the evil. And we can only do that, and this is the one thing that O'Donovan points out, that Aquinas didn't pull apart completely, which is why natural law from Aquinas is more like modern teaching. Without repentance, which amazingly Alan brought up this morning again, as part of the deal, it doesn't grow in the same way. And O'Donovan, with an incredibly detailed and deep analysis of Western history, draws this out beautifully. When we are shown what is wrong as Christians, if we ask for the gift of repentance, and it is a gift that needs to be asked for. My favorite verse in respect to that is relates very much to us as the Gentiles. Biblical quizzes. When, in the story of Cornelius, Peter was forced to go and talk to Cornelius by having the vision, which was really pushing hard against his everyday ethics. He was being asked to do things which he would have simply called wrong up to that point, and God said, no, they are not. And he went. And of course, Cornelius was ready, and he and all his family not only believed, but they were touched by the Holy Spirit. Do you think Peter was happy about that? There's a bit of a mixture in there, wasn't it? If you come from a church that really doesn't believe in tongues and you find yourself slain in the Spirit and you start praying in tongues, are you going to be a happy camper when you all come to afterwards? It's like that. It must have been like that. So Peter had to go back and tell the old Jews what he'd done. Do you think they were ready for it? No. But Luke, being the wonderful writer he is, and he talked to them all, obviously. Do you know, can any one of you tell me what convinced the old Jews that it's time? What they said? It's wonderful. Then, to the Gentiles also, God has given the gift of repentance. Isn't that wonderful? We can't even repent at will. Ask any spouse. Saying sorry is not repentance, is it? It's usually a plea for can we return to normal relations without too much serious discussion. It's a gift we have to ask for. And that wasn't available in the way that it's available to us until after the resurrection. The new life, the new world, begins on Easter Sunday. And you can read the history of medicine with that as a key underpinning, and it makes so much more sense as you work your way through. Most of you should know this, but some of you won't. I think I've got it in this one. Otherwise, I'll paraphrase it. Well, it goes like this. It becomes every man who commits to the serving of others to consider the four following things. First, that all his skills and judgment were given by God and should therefore be used for his glory and the good of mankind. That's Thomas Sydenham in the 17th century. The second Hippocrates is what he's often called. The first man to take patient histories seriously and collate them. That was the beginning of modern research. It didn't lead to major steps forward for another couple of hundred years. Not until the 1860s did it really take off. Even though we'd seen, or at least the Dutch guy von Leeuwenhoek, was it? Yeah, had seen microbes with his amazing lens that had a times 300 effect, but you had to hold it within a millimeter of your eye. That changed things. And Sydenham ends that the reason that we have for compassion is that we know we're going to need it too. It's the most beautiful description of what it means to be a doctor that I know. You can get it from CMDA, and of course David, being who he is, he immediately got it properly framed so you can buy it as a thing to put in your office. Sydenham's oath is much better than any modern oath because it has transcendence in it, first of all. And without transcendence and without a Christian story, the reasons for doing what we do were not there. And certainly, the number of doctors over the last 20 years, or a bit more, who have died of HIV, they knew the risk they were taking. Many modern students say, I didn't sign up for that. I signed up for a career which would bring a good income. I'm not going to do that. When I was doing nephrology in London, we didn't have the hepatitis vaccine. Several residents died during my time of HIV. Hepatitis B, I mean, somebody only had to cough and you get a drop on your conjunctiva and you can get the disease and die of acute yellow atrophy in a week or two. But up until, let's face it, the 1860s, doctors went into those environments and gave their lives. Galen was overwhelmed by the fact that during plague, Christians stayed. He left, and so did everyone else. And the Christians were not immune. They died. If you want it in novel form, Manzoni's famous novel, The Betrothed, Italian writer. So it's for doctors, it's an amazing story of an outbreak of plague.
The Pope's favorite novel.
What?
The Pope's favorite novel.
Really? Yes. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Do you enjoy it too?
Yes, and there's actually a children's version.
I don't believe that. How would they do that? Is it good?
Yes, it is.
Sally, a new one for your list. You mean there's a beating heart beneath the swinging brick, you know? No. Well, that's good. Wonderful. Yeah. I look forward to seeing what it's like. I mean, I don't like the film of one of our favorite books, which is the lovely story of the missionary in China, The Keys of the Kingdom. You know that one? They made a film of it. Never watched the film. But the book for Christians is a... It's based on a true story, and Cronin was a good writer of, you know, just below the top level. But that story is probably our family's favorite novel. And if you haven't read it, you will thank me for that, I'm sure. But back to O'Donovan, he traces this process that Galen saw, that Manzoni account gives an account of. Why did it happen? Because of the story of Christ. When Jesus washed the disciples' feet, he said, you will understand this later, but you call me Master and Lord, and I have washed your feet. What should you do? And there it is. It's laid out immediately. Do what needs to be done. And of course, you're rewarded. Wonderful. Granddaughter from Malawi has been running a clinic for women with indolent tropical ulcers since she was 13. They come back from the fields and they come in at the gate of the compound and she cleans up their ulcers and dresses them and sends them on their way. The children, I mean, she was a child at that point. They are wonderful in that capacity to have kindness, aren't they? Unless you become as a little child, it's got a lot of meaning. So I wanted to put that sort of general introduction into the fact that, of course, we're now reaching a space where this is no longer true in the way that it was. And I've read this week a book called, The Science of the Good, which particularly if your children are going to do psychology, is a book you should read with them. Because Hunter from Virginia, University of Virginia, points out in that there are a lot of people like Churchland and others. There's a big push to say that everything can be described, including morality, by neurophysiology and neuroscience. They've been saying for years that the big problem in the next little while at the scientific level is going to be neuroscience and neuropharmacology. And he shows out what I hadn't nailed, and he does it beautifully. He shows how they have become, the people pushing this are without exception rigorous naturalists. Reductionistic science. If it can't be measured, it isn't real. And once you have that as the undeniable foundation for what you're going to do, the ethics that come out of that are not going to be the same as ours. And what Hunter does, being a very good philosopher, is show the intellectual defects in their position. But most of us couldn't do it in the way that he does. I will have to read that section several more times and then write a précis of it. And in a year or two's time, I'll be able to do it as he does it. But at least I can tell you where to find the way to read it and think about it. He also does, which would be very useful to many of you, he does a very good intellectual history of how this came about, from nasty, brutish and short, Hobbes. It's amazing the number of people who read Calvin and Hobbes who don't realize that the names are of deep significance. I love the situation where Hobbes pushes Calvin into the mud and says, well, nasty, brutish and short. And lots of people didn't get it. I mean, he's got to be a Christian, the guy who wrote that, drew that cartoon. So that reductionistic process that took over after the new birth of science in the 13th century had given us inductive reasoning in place of deductive reasoning, and therefore empirical observation as the start of everything, then you get the psychology they're dealing with now. And it explains a lot of what's going on. Now, what about euthanasia? Euthanasia was known to be wrong forever, and it was done forever. It was one of the reasons that Hippocrates did what he did, because in the ancient world, doctors killed for profit. They still do in Africa. The witch doctor, rightly called, there are natural healers and they're different, but the witch doctor is feared. If you go into a village and the witch doctor comes in, everybody backs away, except us. And the witch doctor actually said to me once, I can't touch you, your spirit is stronger. That's a category of character that I don't know how to talk about, but it's very real to him. I've had that several times. One pastor that I really trusted, and when I was planning to go off on some direction I'd never been before, I would say to him, Pastor Martin, is that a good idea? And he wouldn't answer me. He said, I'll go and pray about it. The same sort of guy who says that missionaries need cushions, Africans' knees have knees in training when it comes to the prayer meeting. But he would go away and pray, and then he'd come back. And I remember him saying, you may go that way. I wouldn't send many people that way, but your spirit is strong enough. He looked upon certain parts of that area as being much more troubled by evil spirits than others. Now, the New Testament would certainly fit in with that. I wouldn't recognize an evil spirit if I met one, I'm afraid. Going to Africa gives me some sense of that. You do get a sense this is a dark place. But nothing that comes close to the descriptions we get in the New Testament. But there are people who, in the modern world, who know that. And Lewis, a long while back, didn't he, said that evil spirits had been banished for Europe for centuries, and now we're inviting them back. And certainly there are people who live darkly troubled lives in ways that would be explained by evil spirits. I just don't know how to recognize them. Some of you may, and it will be interesting to hear from you in the question period. So Hippocrates, in his time, doctors killed for pleasure, killed for profit. So if you're going to see the witch doctor, he can help you in some things, but he can also kill you. And are there people around you who want you dead? Yes. Mobutu, one of the worst African leaders, had his own personal witch doctor. And if he wanted to get rid of you, he'd often invite you to dinner at that level. You wouldn't see the white powder on the plate. I think it's over 30 people that were documented as dying rather acutely after having dinner with Mobutu. That's the world that they lived in. He knew that power depended upon getting rid of any competitors, and he did that. That's not our world, but it's the world we increasingly are going to deal with. So what those amazing Hippocratic physicians did is they realized that that way of doing medicine was corrosive of trust. He didn't have much in the way of medicines, but he didn't call it a placebo effect or anything like that, but he understood that people will get better if they trust the doctor than if they don't. And that means if we have anonymous doctors or paper-replaceable doctors, trust is never going to develop under those circumstances. Most people go into medicine because they're like people and are rather appalled to find that in hospital, you're not allowed to get to know anyone now. I mean, you're fooling yourself, aren't you, if you think the people coming in for a 24-hour period during which they don't even eat because there's so many tests to be done, that you can get to know them? The only people you get to know are the ones that you deal with for chronic disease, really, isn't it? Those are the ones you get to know. And that they're trying to reduce those dramatically by eugenics. So one of the fundamental features of medicine for the first 1800 years of the, or 1900 years of the Christian tradition was trust. And now it's being not even allowed to grow. It's fascinating to me as I travel around to, and this, you're doing, see, one of the two people, two docs here is doing forecash medicine with trust. That is working. I know several now. Always very closely related to a church. And basically the way it works is they say, this is really going into tomorrow's talk a little bit, but you can be thinking about it. Take out insurance, but only for catastrophe. And then we'll do it on a fee-for-service for everything else. And if Johnny falls off the swing, I'll come out and stitch him up. You don't need to bring him to Emerge or anything like that. And yes, the ones I know, and I imagine you too, live fairly simple lives, but they live appreciated lives. And that's a big difference that's happened during my medical lifetime, is you did get to know the patients and you were appreciated. Did get paid, but appreciated, which was nice. And it all goes back, and O'Donovan lays out for you the way this came about in our tradition. Now, once inductive reasoning, empirical observation, two hypotheses, two proof in inverted commas, what we did before has gone. The bigger context has been removed, and we live in this narrow reductionistic box. Certainly the bureaucrats who run medicine, who don't have no interest in anything that can't be measured, right? Euthanasia to them is what? Cost savings. Why? When do we spend our money? Last few weeks or months of life. So, say they, in their simplistic way, if we can get people to die a little earlier, we save a lot of money. You won't. The people who will be in really big business will be the psychiatrists. Because if you've helped in some way or encouraged or whatever to push your mom or dad or whoever out of life a little earlier, you're going to feel guilty about that for the rest of your life. It's going to be a problem. The problems will be different, but I suspect healthcare costs will go up, not down. And we won't be able to handle them. So the other thing, of course, when the material naturalistic world dominates, what happens to our understanding of the immaterial world? It diminishes. It must. Now, every society has to have an honor code of some sort. But now we have formal honor codes in medical school, and they sign them. And yet the trust levels are going down year by year. The community that I grew up in, a working class community in Birmingham, had no written down honor code, but everybody knew what it was. It shows even in sports. It's one of those areas where that rather silly game of the English cricket, because it's so sophisticated, the umpire has a very difficult job. He's 22 yards from where the ball and the bat meet. And unlike baseball, where they're always trying to throw at 200 miles an hour, in the right conditions when it's rained and the ball's got a seam on it and if the ground is a bit wet, the ball hits the ground before it gets to the bat, it can turn at a right angle. It's not going fast, and you can be caught behind the bat by a row. In the really bad conditions, you see every fielder. It's not spread all around. They're all within 10 feet of the bat. Because if you try to hit it, you'll miss it. And if you try to follow it, you get the edge and you get caught. Absolutely astonishing to see somebody moving a ball about 45 miles an hour and you can't hit it. You might be able to stop it. But whether you've touched it or not, 22 yards away, you can't hear, and the deflection may be so much you can't be convinced. What did we used to do? If you touched it, you stepped away from the wicket to tell the umpire, I'm out. And if you didn't do that at school, what happened to you? You got the reputation you deserved, and you'd be given out when you weren't. Does anyone in international sports still do that? One. Adam Gilchrist, the last and greatest wicketkeeper the Australians had, and you know the next bit of the story, don't you? He was a Christian. The rest of the team hated the fact that he did it, but they loved him. And he got them out of trouble so many times. Extremely talented man. But what a wonderful witness. At lower levels, you still find a few Christians who actually incorporate their ethics into what they do. But of course, in modern sports, it's all about winning. And the world is diminished. That's the point about all Wendell Berry's novels. He doesn't preach anywhere. But he starts at the time of the one-room schoolroom with Miss Minnie and Ptolemy, and he brings you up very close to the modern period, showing the gradual erosion of the community. He himself stopped going to church because he couldn't stand it anymore. He goes walking in the woods. It's just too much for him to go to church. He's very sad. The world getting less than it used to be. His, particularly for women, Hannah Coulter is a novel about a good woman, a good Christian woman, who had quite a hard life. But it's a page-turner. Very difficult to write a novel about a good person that's a page-turner. And what's deeply moving about it, of course, you can't think of many people who would be like Hannah Coulter. Same thing. Now, so we have a medical practice that's increasingly divorced from any larger context. It has no space for the immaterials, certainly not taught explicitly. That the ethics that your colleagues coming to you over the next few years will be tied to, insofar as they're tied at all, come from Georgetown. I call it the Georgetown mantra. How many of you were taught autonomy, justice, beneficence, non-maleficence? With no overarching story as to how that would work. And of course it doesn't work. And that's the problem. Amazingly, they had a celebration at Georgetown of 25 years since the original Georgetown mantra was published. Now, Pellegrino is a very devout Orthodox Catholic and a very respected internist, the most respected in the Georgetown Hospital. So he was invited to the celebration. And they rather foolishly invited him to give the final address, which was quite brief. He said, it's been wonderful to meet so many friends and all the usual sorts of things. But he said, I have to say that the only defense the patient actually has at the end of their life is the ethics of the physician. Because these things cannot be enforced, can they? You can all, as I could, kill patients and nobody would ever find out. I have one way of doing it, with a meal. If I'm ever in need of money, I could write quite an interesting thriller. I doubt whether even Miss Marples would sort out what had been done. And the victim would have to be somewhat snobbish about gourmet food. But given that, I could kill him and eat the meal myself, and I'd be fine, and he wouldn't. In fact, I have two ways of doing that. So beware. we're in that state. I mean, that British GP who killed about 45 people found that he became addicted to it. He was crying out for help for a long while. In the end, he got a woman to change her will in his favor at 10 in the morning and killed her at 3 in the afternoon before somebody actually noticed. He committed suicide in prison. But now, of course, unless they could prove she hadn't given consent, there's nothing they could do about it. And that's going to be difficult to prove. So the reason it's happening now as opposed to before is because from Hippocrates onwards, doctors knew the story that not killing patients increases trade. So other people had to join because people are not stupid. They watch you go to the Hippocratic doctors, you have more chance of coming back alive, even cured. So everybody did it. And there was no attack on it until after Darwin. And that's not surprising, really, is it? And the attack, of course, was led by people who bought deeply into the Darwinian story. It is no answer for individual altruism. You cannot derive it from the Darwinian model. Darwin's, was it? A close relative of Darwin. I always get wrong whether it's nephew or what it is. But he was the founder of the eugenics movement. The basic idea that we should breed better people. That's where it would naturally come from. Now, of course, initially, nobody did anything very explicit. That took a little while. We just theorized about it and said things like, we ought to breed better people without any discussion of the ought or the better. That the change didn't happen till the 1930s, and I've already talked about this once, I think. I have, correct? How many of you have got down the Nazi doctors on your reading list now? That's where it started, with the handicapped and with the rest. So that's where we now live. We live in a story where the university as a whole has accepted naturalistic science as being an explanation of everything. Not the best philosophers don't, but who listens to them these days? There are some really good writers that you could keep up with. How many of you have not yet come across David Bentley Hart? Oh, well, that's another good thing to happen to you. Try Atheist Delusions, which is a response to Dawkins. It's incredibly clever and also quite funny. The other thing, if you're too sucked into that, Dawkins and Lennox, you can find on YouTube twice. They've debated twice. Dawkins will never debate Lennox again, because Lennox looks like everybody's favourite uncle, slightly dishevelled, but with a mind like a razor blade and a very kind heart. In fact, there's a lovely piece in a British newspaper of a journalist who went before the debate to talk to both of them. And she was, as she said, I was entirely on Dawkins' side, but I found him to be a prickly snob. Lennox, who I was opposed to, was so warm and friendly and inviting that he almost won me over by personality alone. But what he's got is a mind that is logical. He gives an account. It's a lovely example of how you do this. He lives in Green College, Oxford, one of the modern colleges. And one of the rules they have is a bit like Deer Valley when it's running efficiently, where you don't sit by the same person twice for a meal. And you also come with your spouse. So you find out where you're seated when you have these regular dinners. So John and his wife, another Sally. We're the only other John and Sally they know. We're sitting down, and there was a biochemist sitting next to him, and you introduce yourself, and John asked the guy what he did. He said, I do biochemistry, a famous biochemist. And then he asked John what he did. He said, well, I'm a mathematical cosmologist, but I spend a lot of time doing Christian apologetics. And the biochemist said, well, we're not going to have a very good meal, are we? I'm a naturalist to the core. And John said, I don't see that that should mean that we don't enjoy the meal. Tell me, what's on the menu? And he picked it up and he said, whatever it was, chicken. And John said, could you take that menu to your laboratory and derive that information from it? And he was honest enough. He said, no, I couldn't, and it troubles me a lot. And his wife said, well done. This is going to be a good meal. But it's true. It's true. The world is comprehensible, and that's amazing. We need to be more in awe of the fact that it's comprehensible. Oliver O'Donovan points out how this, the difference is revelation plus knowledge plus thought. When you take the revelation out, things fall apart, especially the revelation about sin. So now we have reached a stage where people have accepted the Protagorean tainted food, that man is the sum of things, to say what is that it is and what is not that it is not. And if that is so, if you believe that, then abortion and euthanasia are perfectly ethical, because that's the best ethical system you can derive from that base. So we shouldn't be saying it's wrong at first sight. It should say the better way for us is, what would you need to believe in order to reach the conclusion that people who want to die should be killed? And what would you need to believe in order to get to the conclusion that would be a bad mistake? Now you've invited them into a discussion that they need to have. And they cannot call you a bigot. They can call us bigots when we do insist on placing our belief system in pride of place with no objection. No, we don't, and we don't need to do that. Jesus never did anything like that. He always went to where the person was and then said, let me tell you a story. We should tell a lot more stories. Sally sometimes likes to have it all written down, and so does Aaron, and it's good to have those people. I think Aaron's going to come with me on my next trip to Texas, and I hope at the end of the talk he said what he actually meant to say was bang, 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 bang. And I would enjoy that, the audience would enjoy that, and we'd all benefit, actually. But what gets under people's skins is narrative. You remember your medicine to a very great degree, and you can put a face to it, can't you? Sometimes you can even tell the story of the patient who changed the way you practice medicine. There are very few teachers you can say that about. And when you do say it about them, like in my life, there's one who did that, who taught me medicine to a large degree. It was because he was so brilliant. And he synthesized so many things in such a small space. And you can't believe this, being Americans at this stage, but he wrote in a standard British textbook of medicine in the 1950s, 60s, an account of the whole of renal disease in 12 pages. And I used that approach for the rest of my life, even when I was reading Welt if I wanted something, you know. It was a brilliant pathophysiological understanding of what was going on. And those sorts of teachers are incredibly rare. He also taught me something that I know I could catch you, most of you, out. When you were taught to examine the chest, you're told to put your hand on the chest and get the patient to say something in a deep voice, right? Why do you do that? It's very good for missionary doctors to know the real answer. Why do you do that? What are you feeling for? You've been doing it for years. Surely you know why you do it. Yes, you're feeling vibration, but why? Almost there. What this brilliant guy said, look, when you listen to chest, you can only listen to two things, volume of sound and pitch of sound. Plot those on a graph. Now, the normal has lots of low frequencies and no high. When you get a pneumonia, you get all frequencies coming through. The only reason you put your hand on the chest is to not feel anything. And then you know there is fluid there. It's a test. Can I put a needle in this chest and get fluid? That is incredibly valuable in Africa, where you might not have an X-ray that's working. But you know, you can, if it's not there, you put a needle in and you might find tuberculosis under the microscope. And I don't know any textbook that teaches that. He published it in a very short paper in The Lancet in the 60s. He got so fed up with students not thinking, he actually did the experiment. Pure tone in here, measure on the chest, find the classic cases. Four lines, you know, normal, effusion, consolidation, three lines. And that was it, published it. And it didn't get picked up. And yet, many of you have been on mission hospitals. You know, when you're seeing 300 patients a day, you can actually say 99. If you've got nothing there, that's a patient to do something with. But that kind of teaching is rare because those kinds of steps forward don't happen very much. If you take the intellectual history of science as a whole, I'm overstating it a bit, but I usually say if you took the top 200 names and everybody else's science evaporated, we wouldn't be badly off. We'd have most of what we need. And we'd fill in the bits we've been filling in. There'd be a lot more PhDs. You know, that's what PhDs do, is fill in the bits. But the people who make a real difference, there's only been one Mozart, one Beethoven. And everybody remembers them. Only one teller of parable stories like Jesus. You know. So that world out there, which is the immaterial world, because that's what's happening, we've got to find every way we can to draw people's attention to it. So it's very, students when they arrive, they still come from a Judeo-cultural history, Judeo-Christian cultural history to a considerable degree. And they're well-intentioned. When you arrived in medical school, you wanted to help people in almost every case. Now there are people who come because they want the money, but that used not to be the case. Certainly when I went to medical school, it wasn't the most well-paying job in the world by any means. So when they're doing that, I say, why do you want to do that? And when they do good things, why do you do that? My office was always a bit of a mess, and the door was always open. If I found a student waiting for me, and it was exam time, I couldn't resist. It wasn't true, but I couldn't resist. I said, did you look at the exam? And of course, they'd get furious, and if they were Christian, I'd tell them I'm just teasing. But if they were good humanists, which they were, I'd say, well, you're a Darwinian, aren't you? You've just passed up an opportunity to give your genes a push over the others. Why didn't you do it? It works. And you need to be looking around every day for a point where people are actually being parasitic on the Judeo-Christian story without realizing it. And if you can make them realize that, you've done them a great service. And that's one thing euthanasia is going to do. So the first question, what would you need to believe to? Be the one or the other. The other question to ask is, why are we so bothered about pain now? I mean, it's a new thing, relatively speaking. I mean, doctors have always killed patients at some time or other. You know, King George was in a conscionable time of dying, and then the doctor visited him and he agreed to die, so to speak. In politics, it's happened in that kind of way. And we've all felt the desire, haven't we? How can't we get this over? You know, when somebody is dying a hard death and the people with them are still... I still see the first time I really felt that. Nobody had ever talked to me about that as a medical student. You know, 15-year-old boy, only child of elderly parents, who came in with a nosebleed but wouldn't stop. But of course, it was... I've forgotten the name of the syndrome now. I knew it then and made the diagnosis immediately, a collagen disorder, which was fatal in weeks. And dying, it was hard to get drips in and things. And nobody had prepared me. Nobody had said anything. I didn't know what to say to the parents. You need a big story to cope with things like that. That's why another thing that will come up tomorrow, but I want to plant the seed now. In your church, do you have a patient advocacy program? People who know their way around medicine, who can make sure that the current aggressively naturalistic medicine doesn't destroy their souls at the end of their life, or give them treatment that they don't really need. In other words, allows their faith to dominate their dying and not medical science. Robert Spitzer puts it like this. He says, what the current medical administrators are trying to do will effectively take away the most redemptive period of most lives. Because in the last few weeks of your life, you realize, if I don't reconcile now with people I ought to have reconciled with years ago. I'm not going to do it ever. She says, you know, Jim hears Bill's dying and they fell out 40 years ago and neither of them can remember why. So Jim goes to visit Bill and they never even talk about it. They burst into tears and hug one another and say, how did we allow this to happen? That's what's supposed to happen at the end. It's the last chance to reconcile. So we're trying to get rid of it by reducing the time that we spend dying.
Should we take a break?
What?
Should we take a...
You can take a break. Yeah, I've hardly got started, but that's okay. unless you want to do a quick summary of the first half. We'll come back to you at the end. There are some bioethicists and ethicists who are convinced that the euthanasia movement is going to be, at the end of this century, the thing that's looked back on as being perhaps the most important event in the century, when the Western world decided that doctors should kill. She's a bit of a loose cannon, but she's always worth reading, is Somerville from McGill. She writes about these things quite often. As far as I know, she's not a deeply committed Christian. The reason, she says, is that in order to do it, as I pointed out to you, you have made ethical and theological commitments which will change the whole nature of the value system of society. And it's not an accident that the only culture that generated science as we know it was, in fact, Christian. That experimental science did not develop anywhere else. That's just a fact. But once you start thinking about it, you can see why. The surface of life can be pretty chaotic. Just look outside. People do get blown away by volcanoes and mudslides and all the rest. So at first sight, yeah, it's beautiful, it's stunning, but it's dangerous. So only the belief in the love of God that was given to us through the life of Christ is really sufficient to override that and say, yeah, okay, God knows what he's doing. Suffering is part of our lives, and it's part because God recognizes that, as Lewis puts it, he speaks to us in our joys and shouts at us in our sorrows, which he does. So the culture that grew out of the books of the Bible, especially when they gave us the vernacular language, and that's often not discussed as much as it should. Latin is a language that no society speaks. And one of the things that the Reformation did, which was not theological, was actually to give the Germans their language in many ways. Luther's Bible in German is the same thing as Shakespeare is for England. And England had been translating the Bible into English. It was getting around. Henry VIII allowed it because the Catholics didn't like it and then tried to stop it. He couldn't stop it then. Because every pub in England, they were discussing the Bible once it was available in English. They cared about theological things. So the translating the Bible into the vernacular has been such an important thing. The Bible translation movements are important for that reason. It was street Greek. It wasn't elegant prose. I mean, the Muslims love the Arabic of the Quran. They say it's the most beautiful book in the world. I don't speak Arabic. I take their word for it. The Bible is beautiful for other reasons, isn't it? It has the capacity to make you cry. To change, to cause you to repent. So that's why our world became the way it was, but now our world is no longer formed in that way. I mean, the questions that are raised is, does life have intrinsic value or extrinsic value? That's the question where does human value come from? What is euthanasia implying? It's implying that when I can't do something, then I'm better off dead. Is that true? No, of course not. Once you put it that way, you begin to see that. That's what was necessary in abortion, the pulling apart of human person and human being. One had function, the other didn't. So a person, a function-based set of ideas as fundamental to society will have implications, including euthanasia. It's another outcome of it. It's another of the dominoes that fell over. That will be a very different society. The young in university today, sex is just two human bodies touching. That's all. But it's not. And we know that. How do we say that? We are not just products with a sell-by date. We have roles in our life. And what happens at the end of our life? Well, you know, don't you? Which is it best for the family, a sudden death or a longer one? It's a longer one, isn't it? A sudden death is catastrophic for a family. So it might be, we might all like to have a good, sharp, big heart attack or a pulmonary embolus or a ruptured aorta. But we shouldn't wish that on our families. I'm even guilty of saying on occasions, well, I'll probably go down an aircraft crash. I mean, statistically, the number's getting close, you know. But, I mean, no. We ought to want to die in our bed with our families around us, as a witness to the world around us. I really appreciate the fact that the Orthodox community, their funerals are with an open coffin. And children not only go and look at Granny, they give her a kiss. And they say, but that's just Granny's body, isn't it? Granny's gone, and she's getting a new body. Growing up with that approach to death, our deaths are so sanitized now, aren't they? Are you going to allow the people who handle your death to tart you up to look as though you're something you're not? I think the real thing, which gives plenty of opportunity to talk about sin, is a much better way to go. The American way of death spends far too much money and does far too little witness. What proportion of your church actually has their final service in the funeral home? It's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's certainly not a gathering in the church. And in the modern world, christenings or baptisms, marriages and funerals are really the only chance to preach the gospel to most of the community. That will. Germany's got to a stage now where they bury people without any ceremony at all. Well, they don't believe. Rites of passage only make sense if it's a passage. If it's the entry to nothing, why would you celebrate it? Why would you have a ritual for it? Which the world has done forever because it all, everywhere believed that life didn't end with death in one sense or another. In many cases, they feared what they did after death, but it was still a better story than the one we're inhabiting now, where we're just a bunch of chemicals which agree to stay together and live for a while and then it's over. Yeah. No. But that's what's implied. It also reduces our culture in another way. There's a lovely talk given by a friend from Ottawa called John Scott. I know you can find it in a recent edition of Focus, which is the Canadian equivalent of today's Christian Physician. It's better, actually. It's not so glossy, and it has proper essays. Not short things that could be written in the bathroom, you know. It's not worthy of you. I think you could do so much better with that journal. It's taken on modern advertising. I think we should be different. That's why I like First Things. No pictures. Not to think about. But John Scott's a palliative care physician. He was there right at the beginning. He's my age. But he gave a wonderful talk, which is available as a paper in the recent Focus edition, on The nature of lament. See, when somebody's dying and in an ICU and they say, oh, I wish this was over, is that what they're really saying? John suggests no, you need to think more carefully than that. It's a lament. It's really saying, tell me that I matter. How many doctors would recognize a lament? Just listen to Scottish music, it's about the only thing they can play, you know. That's, but they do it well. And that's what's missed. We have lost the humanity to recognize a cry for some sort of approbation at the end of your life. That, no, we are going to miss you so much, we don't want you to go a moment early. Poetry. Young people don't learn poetry anymore, do they? Love bade me welcome, but my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. Yet sweet-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entry in, asked sweetly if I lacked anything. A guest, said I, worthy to be here. You shall be he, said love. I, the unclean, I cannot look on thee. And who made the eyes, said love. You shall sit down and eat my meat. So I did sit and eat. How many, have you ever seen that on a wedding program? That's George Herbert. I think the greatest Christian poet in the English language. But that's just my opinion. But that poem is beautiful. It takes the idea of love and gives it a whole new dimension. And one that Christians should relate to immediately and with warmth. So human warmth will be diminished by this process because it's procedural. And we already know that people get killed in Holland at 500 to 1,000 a year without evidence of consent, and they've got 20 years of statistics, and that in Canada we can therefore expect 1 to 2,000, and you can expect 10 to 20,000 people killed every year without any real informed consent. You think of those people who turn up regularly and emerge, street people and like. Are they going to get resuscitated? Are they going to get sorted out? It'd be easier just to let them die. It happens already. It will happen more. That vulnerable people will become more vulnerable. Now, what makes a society really work at the level of warmth and social services and all the rest? Surely it has got to be the way we care for the weakest and most vulnerable. That's the strength that Jesus taught. I mean, he was constantly doing that, wasn't he? He went to the most vulnerable and he told them that they too were loved by God and made in the image of God. And hospitals, they have been the vanguard for missions, haven't they? Because nothing like it has been seen where they go before. That's why that lovely A.J. Cronin, The Keys of the Kingdom, is really about the way that the ideas of living that Christ gives us change the society as a whole. Is there going to be any meaning to suffering when the easy way out is the right way? Don't suffer, die. And a lot of people say, yeah, that's a good idea. And they'll sign something that says that when they're not in the position they're going to be in. Living wills can kill you. I wouldn't sign one. But tomorrow we'll talk about that in medical care and make sure I do get you to talk about it and think about it. What you need is a power of attorney program in your church. You want the decisions at your death to be made by people who share your faith but are not emotionally involved in your death like your family. You want your family to be there, but it's very clear. Well, let me do this question. When the children get together for mum's death, they all come rushing up in intensive care or in hospital, and mum's not going to get home. Which children will come to terms with her death as it's going to be, and which ones will want everything that can be done, done, You know, well, the moment you think about it, you know the answer, don't you? That's telling you an awful lot. It's true. We all face guilt when those nearest and dearest us die, don't we? Because, well, in our case, it's obvious. We both have lots of repenting to do all the while because neither of us have treated the other as we should have done on every occasion during our life. And I have enough arrogance to presume that you are all in exactly the same state. Therefore, one of the most important things that happens at the end of your life is, in fact, a clearing of those things. Repentance, expression, thanks for what was good, ask for forgiveness for the things that weren't. We all know where we failed our spouses. We all know where we... And we prefer not to talk about it, but that's what should happen at the end. And what those people who come from afar haven't spoken to mum or dad for 10 years, they're just trying to deal with that guilt. You can tell me, please send me an email when you find one, but up till now I have been saying, but I don't check regularly, that I couldn't find guilt in the index of a textbook of internal medicine. If you remove guilt as evidence of depression, which is what the psychiatrists say. You can find it in psychiatric books, and they say guilt, feelings, evidence of depression. The word sin won't occur. When you find one, let me know. But isn't that a giveaway? When we live at a time when at least 70% of the patients who come to see you have things they need to repent of in their lives that play a major role in the causation of their disease. Yeah. We suffer from lifestyle. We can do at least call them lifestyle diseases now, don't we? Some of them. Some of them you can't say that anymore, can you? I do. I think a little truth is important. In fact, I don't think it's kind to people to say that something is not true when it is. And that's where we're at. So that actually should mean that there's a component of care, especially end-of-life care, that deals with this. Now, I don't know what your experience of hospital pastors is like. Mine was not impressive. I tended to look upon them as people who couldn't run a church. That may be a little harsh, but I don't know. But Stephen, that I told you about, the church, the hospital chaplain and his own priest wouldn't handle the issue of death. We do know about it. And the way that you can get it through quite easily, certainly if you're doing chronic disease, because they ask about people dying, because in a clinic where people come regularly, they get to know one another. It's a kind of community, isn't it? So when somebody dies, if it's a Christian, you have a great opportunity to say, oh, they died, but it was a good death, you know. And I say, what do you mean? You're home free. It's a moment of truth. What books do you have that you give away in your office when death comes? You know, if I go into a second-hand bookshop and there's a Diane Comp or a C.S. Lewis, I'm going to pick it up and put it on my shelf and to give away. I think one of the joys of heaven, I hope it will be, is that the many books that I've lost have actually been used. You certainly have to have a high view of the sovereignty of God if you have a library and students visiting. Sally buys replacement copies of various things at various times. I dread to think what the budget is, but it doesn't matter. It's been well used. It's these kinds of things that we're going to have more opportunity to talk about as euthanasia comes along. And the patients, you know, you need to get them thinking about it early along the way. Now, do you have any favourite books that you have come across that you can use in this way?
I think there's a book that I came across which addresses the subject we're talking about. I think in the previous session, but about our practice of death itself and how we celebrate that within the church.
Yeah.
Accompanying that with singing.
Accompanying it with singing, yeah. Yeah.
Which I found helpful for me in thinking about anticipating my own death
and
actually instructive in the death how we approach my mother's death.
Yeah.
You know, some of my siblings are arguing for an open, a closed casket.
Yeah.
It would be injurious to the younger members of their family. And myself expressing the need for this allows us to see that this is who she was in her final bodily state.
Yeah.
But she is no more. And it allowed me to think about societies which increasingly cover up death.
Yeah.
How do we die a good death?
Yeah.
How do we celebrate the life of the person who died in Christ?
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually thought about that because I have some antagonism to quite a lot of the things we sing in church. So I'd better have made it clear what I want sung. My song is Love Unknown would be the first one, which is a hymn that isn't sung very much. My Saviour's love to me, love to the loveless shown that they might lovely be.
I asked Josh this week, I don't know if he's here or not. They just love. The trumpeter, I wanted
to. Yeah, yeah. Or Jeremiah Clark, that's a marvelous passage, yes.
I think Philip Yancey wrote a book about dying, which I liked. It was, it gave some of the history of practices of death, which were better than
I didn't know that, thank you.
And also about suffering, how we suffering.
Yeah. My favorite book on suffering is Peter Kreis's. Making sense of suffering or making sense out of suffering, I can't remember which, but for medical students it's certainly the best. He doesn't pretend that it's easy. He takes the hardest examples. And of course he understands Lewis's point where he said he could not become a Christian because he could not worship a God who allowed the suffering and pain and death that the world has. And then he said, until I suddenly realized, where did I get the idea that the world should be any other sort of world? I got it from this God I won't believe in. So he was actually turned to faith by realizing that death and suffering could only be explained from outside this world, not from inside it. If there is no outside, there is no explanation. It's just the way it is, and the Stoics are the best you can do. You make the most of it because that's all you've got. But if this is only the training ground for the real story, which is yet to come. And the other interesting thing in this area that's fascinating is all these books on near-death experiences. And what's lovely about some of them is that you get accounts by unbelievers who have been stopped in their tracks. I think my favorite one, somebody pushed a book into my hand that CMDA meeting, said, you need to read this. And eventually I got around to reading it. Now I've lost it, of course. Somebody's picked it up, but I'll find it again at some point. But in it, there's a lovely account of a woman who went on bypass and everything went wrong and there was, you know, hours of struggle during which she left her body. And she gives the usual account, you know, floating and looking down. But hers was more extensive. She said, it went on so long, I drifted outside the hospital. And along the outside, and she said, I even remember seeing a rather unusual pair of running shoes on a windowsill. And she described them, and the guy, you know, I'll fix this. Of course they were there. And there's a lot of stuff like this coming along now. I can't remember the title. It might be lying around our house. When I find it, I'll put it on the book list because it is worth reading. And the other one that because of being more involved with pediatrics than elsewhere, children are naive and they just tell it like it is. And there's an account of mom driving her little son from A to B, and he'd had a bypass surgery that didn't go well. It went on for hours. And he said he'd seen Jesus. Well, they said, that was wonderful. But then traveling, he said, he hadn't said much, but he said, Mum, why didn't you tell me I had another sister? And she said, you've only got one sister. He said, no, I've got another one. I've met her in heaven. She's waiting for you to come and give her name. She wasn't aborted. She died in utero. But Mum had never told him. so that the reductionistic world can be got at by these things. How do you make sense of this? Is this just a psychological quirk or what? So we lose the richness of our own humanity when we start buying into a totally reductionistic world. Suicide is legal, but euthanasia is not. Why not? Well, we made suicide legal because they're largely depressed and we didn't want them to kill themselves. They wanted them to complain so we could help them. So legalizing suicide was in order to advance life. Euthanasia is to advance death. They're not the same. They shouldn't be compared. Suicide that's done through euthanasia needs a different name. It is suicide. But most suicide earlier on is not of that variety. And why on earth physicians? I have tried. I don't know anybody who's done this yet, but I really think you guys need to have on your desk not your name, but a question. Do you wish to be cared for by a doctor with or without moral integrity? Do you have the right to have that on your desk? If the administrators come, you say, I'm doing a survey. And you can do the survey, tick them off as they go along, because I am pretty sure they will ask you about it. And they say, why do you need to do it? Of course I want a doctor with moral integrity. That's going to be the answer, isn't it? So why would you want me to kill you? Because that will make me a doctor without moral integrity. Game over. Even Obama wants a doctor with moral integrity. But he hasn't come to the understanding that what we mean by moral integrity is a set of very different stories. Which one do you want? It will work. Certainly you need to teach residents that when somebody higher up tells them to do something, and it can be, if you're a Catholic, for instance, even writing a prescription for contraception. The same argument applies. Don't say no to authority, ask a question. If they ask you to do mad, you say, first of all, ask the question. Does moral integrity play a role in your hospital? Answer, yes. But that you can be the pathologist or whatever is what they're going to say. But then you say, what we provide everything else in terms of as numbers warrant, right? Can you tell me what proportion of patients coming into our hospital would like to be cared for by a doctor with Judeo-Christian ethics and what with secularist ethics? Because currently you're privileging secular ethics. Can you even defend that statistically? No, you can't. We know that in America, don't we? You know that at least 50% of the population are opposed to paying for abortion at the very least. And in fact, are opposed to abortion. They're going to be opposed to abortion. Euthanasia is an even more of a pushover once you work your way through it. Although currently, in most churches, you will find, if you did a survey in your church, so most people think euthanasia should be legalized. If you do it anonymously, and then you'll have reason to give a talk. Now, I've done several of these in churches now. They're always stunned. They have simply never thought about what it involves. So it's your job to see that your church is not ignorant of what's involved. You can do it. It'll get better every time you do it. But it needs to be done. If we don't, we will lose. God allows these things.
You have to say that.
Oh, yes, yeah. I did one in a Catholic church not far away from there, and the question period went for about an hour and a half. But they didn't have a Catholic doctor to do it. They asked me. That's a good point. If euthanasia is not killing, what is it? Another question. Make your own list of questions. Refusal of burdensome treatment, what's that? Is it euthanasia? No. There is no requirement to take burdensome treatment. Why? Because you say, if God wants to keep me alive, he can do so. But to take a treatment which might give me 6 weeks of extra life, but keep me away from my family and my home for most of 6 months, I think that's burdensome and indeed questionable treatment. So we are not required to carry burdens beyond our ability. The lesser of two evils can be chosen. It's a perfectly valid thing. You do it all the while and you have to. It's a valid category. I mean, there are occasions, are there not, in which a lie should be spoken. There's a Jew under the table to a Nazi officer. Well, the subtle one is, by what right would you be asking questions like that? But that might provoke him to a vigorous search. I mean, what's the name? The famous Dutch lady who went to... Corrie ten Boom. She actually said, yeah, we hide them under the table. And everybody laughed and the Nazi officer did nothing. But she was a child. When you're an adult, you face moral dilemmas. And the first thing, I don't know how trained you are in this area, but when you're dealing with these things, there's three things you must do to decide whether an action is moral. You've got to have three categories at least. First, you must ask about the action itself. Then the intent of the actor, and then the outcome. All three ducks have to be in a row for the action to be moral. Very clear, very old, hundreds of years ago, written in the Middle Ages. But that's right. The problematic ones are the difficult ones, and there you have to struggle, we all do. Our intentions really matter. I love that line of Lewis's in Screwtape Letters. He forgives them on the monstrous grounds that they intended to do good. And he does. He tells us we have to look at actions. He doesn't. He looks on our hearts. We can't do that. We have to look at actions. He says, you must judge your teachers by their fruits. But he doesn't do that. He knows exactly what I'm thinking and what I'm intending. That's very frightening and very salutary in a good way. So, yeah, teach your residents. And how do we decide an action is moral? Most of them, I find, have never thought that you could... It's just feeling for them. Now we get to one of the important bits of this talk. How many minutes have I got left? What time's lunch?
It's 11:20 right now.
You've got 20 minutes.
Okay. Is conscience fundamentally a feeling or an act of thought? Now, knowing it's me saying that, you're going to choose thought, aren't you? But let's put it another way. Your friends, when they talk about conscience, do they mean their feeling? They do, largely, don't they? There are two words in the Western culture that have been used in the past to describe conscience. The one from which we get conscience was conscientia. And that was known to be moral feelings, and it was known to be unreliable. Moral thought, there's several words, but the one that was used most was synderesis, although the last pope said a word that we would relate to more easily. Anamnesis would be a better one. What's an anamnestic reaction? One that's built on memory. And anamnesia means thought. And it's very reliable. Now, I was pro-choice because I felt that the woman's problems were dealt with of a rubella baby. I didn't think, I felt. And I accepted that men could not talk about abortion because they did not have the feelings that women had. I accepted that. But it only took one afternoon of sitting in my office and going through the arguments and realizing it was impossible for me to think that. And when I'd really laid the argument out, as I did with you last night, you could see, you could understand that even feminists would not say they wanted to give the pro-choice set of consequences to their children. They've never said that. And as I pointed out, I've had people say, I've never heard it done that way, and that's the beginning of the turning point. That's the turning point. Why did I wait 20 years? Because God could have pushed me when he wanted to. He knows what he's doing, I realize that. There's a right time to do everything. But so you must make that distinction. You must actually ask people, what do you mean by conscience? Do you mean your feelings or do you mean your thoughts? Conscience is asking those three questions. Feeling is just feeling. You could do a lot in your church just by, till everybody gets sick of it, asking them after church on Sunday morning, not how do you feel, how's your thinking going today after that sermon? I mean, the medieval question, they're not the medieval, the Puritans would ask after church service, well, do you know what their question was? It was almost like a liturgy. How goes it with your soul? It's a better greeting, isn't it? It shows genuine interest in the person you're talking to and puts them on the spot for an important set of thoughts. More argument is required amongst Americans, I'm afraid. You don't argue about important questions. Religion and politics are not allowed, are they, in social interaction. So you better start some dinner groups which are for argument. The argument clinic, that would be good, yeah, I like that. And the motto would be Milton's. Where there is a real desire to know, there of necessity there must be much argument. Because argument in good men, and you can add women, which Milton would not have done, is but knowledge in the making. It is. When you have a real argument about something and you lose, you probably don't give in immediately, but if you're at all honest, you'd say, you adopt it as your own. The really smart way is to dump a thought on somebody's plate who has more power than you have and let them claim it. That's fine. I'm not worried about that as long as they come to the right conclusion in the end.
John, one of the things that happens in evangelical circles is argument is viewed as a questionable attitude, a critical spirit.
Yeah. So how do you deal with that?
It's manipulative.
Yes, it is. It's totally manipulative.
Silence opposition.
Yep. So we start thinking about how you're going to do that. The other way that, again, this is a bit of tomorrow, but it's probably, it bears repeating.
Do you mean tonight when you say tonight?
Oh, it's tonight, is it? Okay, the next lecture anyway. I don't know. I don't live that way, you know.
Yeah. We're all getting ready here tomorrow.
So. Yeah. No, the next lecture. Thank you. My wife doesn't even bother, she knows. She'll make sure I get the right place at the right time. But do you have reading groups in your church? Worth doing. The best way to raise the level is to propose a problem that people recognize as being important that they can't answer. If you go to my website, just to make it easy, there's about 5 or 6 papers from First Things listed there, and they're listed because they would serve this function. Depending on your group, if it was a women's group, I'd probably suggest Robert Jensen's one, How the World Lost Its Story, of which there are now 2 versions 20 years apart. I was delighted when First Things did, I think on their 20th anniversary, their top list of papers, and they agreed with me, so they got it right. Not quite, but Robert Jensen was in there. He was a professor somewhere in Minnesota, halfway to the Mayo Clinic, I think. I've forgotten the name of the St. Olaf's, is it, or something like that. We've got some people from Minnesota that they probably don't know. Anyway, that's one. On these issues, Budiszewski's The Revenge of Conscience is a magnificent article, about 11 pages, beautifully written. The one that has had the most impact on me over time is David Bentley Hart's Christ and Nothing. But that is not an easy paper to read, so I wouldn't put it first. There are others there, but they give you a sense of what I suggest you do is you read it yourself and then take a paragraph out that really got to you and ask your pastor whether you can put it in the bulletin. And underneath, just put, if this paragraph interests you, please come and talk to me. Mm-hmm. And you've got a reading group. Now, I know they work. I don't remember the name, but there's a physician somewhere in this noble country who heard me give a talk called Why Doctors Don't Hate Church. And he said, you're right. And he started looking. I said, well, identify them. And he started sitting in the narthex and just watching the behavior of people coming to church. And he noticed there was more than one man who was very kind to his family. He drove right up to the door under the covering and dropped them off. And he said, I'll park. Well, he did park, but at Starbucks. He came back shortly before Mom and the children came back from Sunday school, so that he was in the church. And he wasn't alone. So he started a reading group for the guys that he saw were not enjoying church. And it just took... They had their meeting while everybody else was in Sunday school. Oh, you choose whichever one you want. I mean, that's your job. First, you identify the people who are clearly not having their minds satisfied in church. Then you ask yourself the question, which areas have I had intellectual satisfaction that has led to spiritual growth? Find a paper that will deal with that. Take a paragraph out and you're away. This is one where it's important that you say, we will meet when you have all read this paper. So that they don't come... You can't do this sort of thing cold in an hour. You want to do it first. Ideally, it's a reading group that, say, meets for coffee or breakfast or whatever. But you can do it in church for the guys who have very busy lives. I mean, when you arrive at church on Sunday morning and you've had a bad week, do you really want a happy clappy song to be the first thing you're greeted by? It's not. It does nothing, does it? I mean, you need some comfort. You need to know that God knows what you've been through in the last week, and He cares about it. You know, O Lord, unto whom all our hearts are open, all desires known. Now that reaches you immediately. If they're going to insist on jigging up and down and singing make you happy songs, it would be good to have a reading group for people who can come after they've got over that. And you've got to the real church. So that's another thing that comes in there. The next thing that you need to talk about is ends and means. What are proper ends and what are proper means? Now, the end of a good death is a good end. Is euthanasia a good means? No, it's not. It's a confusion of the two. Now, it is a good means if you believe that life has no ultimate meaning. Certainly not good news if you're going to tell God afterwards, well, I didn't think I could trust you to choose the date. Are you willing to say that? I think not. So, what I'm going through, of course, is a list of things that have been and will be more perverted as we accept euthanasia in our society. And you can see immediately how they go on. Autonomy is looming its ugly head time and time again. Autonomy outside a framework of law should be always spoken of as what it is, anarchy. And euthanasia is an anarchic movement, and it will be bad for society for that reason. What does euthanasia say about suffering? Not worth anything. It takes away the meaning of suffering. And yet, you have all seen, haven't you, where suffering is so important to our society. I mean, a Down syndrome child doesn't know that they're suffering in one sense, but in other senses, they know that they're missing something. And yet, what do they do for the people around them? The medievals are right. Those that suffer are closer to God. It's the way it happens. Amelia, what would you say about her? Could your family imagine what it would be like without her? But none of you would sign up to do her job, so to speak. It has to be given by God. But when he gives what's necessary to go with it. The slippery slope is real. It's euthanasia now. Shortly, it will be killing people we don't want. And we will get used to it. Don't think we're any different. That's how the right to euthanasia in Germany developed, why should we think we're going to be any different? Well, the Dutch have done it. It's not euthanasia for a street person to be killed without being treated as a human being. It's totally dehumanizing, disrespectful to their humanity, and dehumanizing to the people who do it. Yeah.
What's the status of the right of conscience in the Netherlands?
Hmm?
What is the status of the right of conscience for physicians in the Netherlands with this all this?
Well, they're very, very instrumentalist in their approach. They also have a good history, so they do many things right. They're much better, for instance, at sexual education for children. They give the job to family practitioners, not the schools. Because they're smart. The Dutch are very down to earth. That program in schools is predicated on a very stupid idea that we all go through puberty on the same day. I mean, when those talks are being given, one boy's playing with Lego and another boy's playing with girls and not with dolls. Those two boys are not in the same world, are they? They're very practical. No, they're not. No, you can, of course, say it, but every one of the limits that was put in place has been abrogated at some point. The most egregious one that you will remember happened some years ago, and it stopped a second attempt at euthanasia in the Canadian Parliament. A doctor was brought over by some pro-life people who heard him speak, and it was just a narrative, but what a narrative. He was an oncologist in Amsterdam, and he was brought over simply to tell the committee this story. He said, in my job as an oncologist in Holland, we do home visits, which you don't do here, I know. And he said, I was asked to go and see a woman with terminal stage cancer who had called in to say she was suffering with breathlessness. So I went to see her, and when I got there and examined her, she had rather a lot of fluid in her chest. And I said, look, you know we can't cure you, but we can get the fluid off your lungs, and a short, sharp dose of a drug will stop the cells in their tracks for a bit, and it won't accumulate too quickly. Not enough for you to be toxic with it. Well, probably keep you in hospital for a couple of days. And she said, I'm not going to hospital, they'll kill me. He said, I'm not in that group at all. I will not do that. I will look after you. So she came in, and he did it, what he said he would do. And even the next day, which was, I think, a Saturday, he said to her, you're a bit better, aren't you? And she agreed she was. And he said, I think you'll be ready to go on Monday. On Sunday, he said, I won't be in tomorrow. On Sunday, another guy comes into the ward, and it's full, and he wants a bed. He goes through the notes, finds this woman with documented metastatic cancer and kills her without consent or anything to get the bed. On Monday, the other guy comes in and he loses his cool in public when he discovers what's happened, and he shouts at the other physician in the hospital. He is punished for unprofessional behavior. Nothing happens to the doctor who killed the patient. Now, our Senate committee would not believe that that could happen. So they spent the money and had a video link to Amsterdam, spoke to the college, who said, all the rules are working well, it's an excellent system, but confirmed every detail of that doctor's account. That stopped it dead in its tracks. We're not good at doing that. That doctor I told you about, the professor, your mum asked for euthanasia, we've done it, come and collect the body, please. That's what you get to. So yes, it will coarsen us in various ways. And Holland's story is one of the most amazing that I don't understand. It had the most Christian government that any country in the Western world has had at the end of the 19th century. I put it later than that, but I put it too late. Kuiper was involved. And yet, they resisted killing the handicapped for Hitler. And then a generation and a half later, they become the first country in the world to kill patients. And their churches are empty. Nat Nouwen was from Holland originally. And he's got a lovely passage in one of his books where he says he's looking at the scenery of his home country and there are churches all over it, Catholic and Protestant, and they're not being used. Not really. I mean, when you're killed, other people are relieved after a day or two and they get used to it. It doesn't... You just go around your church and ask how many people think patients should be enabled to choose when they die. That will show you how far we've got into individualism. I doubt whether anyone will say that's God's problem, it's not mine. I hope they will, but can you imagine anyone in your church who would say that reflexly and immediately? Would you even? Would I have done a few years ago? No, I would now. But that's been a learning process. So normalizing euthanasia will diminish gentleness and compassion. It must. There's no way it avoids it.
To clarify, are physicians there across the board required to do it?
In Ontario, they have just said... In Holland, no. No, they're not. Holland are better in that respect. But it's been done for all sorts of trivial reasons now. Yep.
But in Canada, you're not required...
At least to make effective referrals in Ontario. In the prairie, in Alberta, and I think now in Manitoba, no. There's big pushback happening in Ontario. It was because the Catholic who's the secretary of CMDS at the moment, thought that the law was the way to go, and with another lawyer, they took a legal approach. They should not have done it that way. They should have done it on the level what this does to the moral status of medicine as a whole, and they didn't do that, which is sad.
John, did you say that no food and drink, which happens so often at the animal stages of life, is that committing euthanasia?
Well, you need the three.
I know.
What is your intent? If your intent is to kill, clearly it's euthanasia, but... You shouldn't fuss about people who stop eating and drinking at the end of their lives. We are actually superbly adjusted to not eating, total fast. We are not adjusted for partial fasts. And all of us have got enough fat on our bodies to keep us going for several months. And the great advantage of burning fat, which you will burn completely in... a couple of weeks, you won't be burning anything else. Your carbohydrate's gone in 24 hours. Then for a little while, you have to burn muscle to get a little bit of sugar you need. But shortly afterwards, almost everything is switched to feeding on ketone bodies perfectly happily, free fatty acids. And the benefit of that is when you're burning fat, fat is metabolized to CO2 and water. You have nothing that needs to come out through the kidney. Or virtually nothing. Most of the water you have is to keep your kidneys going. That's why you need it. Otherwise, you don't want crystalline urea coming down. It would be very painful. But if you're fasting, it's not a problem. So when they at the end of lives, when people first they don't want to eat, and then they really only want to sip. That's all they need. They've got 400 mils of water a day coming out from the burning of fat. And I know Americans carry their little plastic water bottles around with them all the while. You don't need as much water as you drink. Your body is well designed. There's a good designer behind it. It's ridiculous. I mean, all it does is irrigate the whole system.
this procedure, John, is what? This procedure is...
Yeah, well, fortunately, they don't know enough biochemistry. They won't be very successful. If they were really wanting to kill them, they'd give them a little bit of sugar, a chocolate bar, and then stop the water, you know, that way. Or better still, a protein bar. That would be a really good way to kill them.
Well, you're giving away secrets.
The elderly people.
Yeah. You're joking. Ask the surgeons. What's the joy of operating in Africa? You don't have to cut through 6 inches of fat to get to the muscle.
You see emaciated people.
A few. You're thinking of Cuba.
On the ward, and no food and drink means.
If they're doing that, it would be, but that's not a common problem for you guys, is it?
It's not.
No, not in America.
No.
No.
Isn't that being done to children in England, though?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, even children. The same applies, yeah.
It's a passive way.
Yes. Now, that's why intent is the central issue. I would not. I would offer water. I wouldn't push it, and I wouldn't. They would have to ask for food. Are you hungry? Yeah. But I know what's going on. That's the way God has designed us to die. We shift our metabolism over quite dramatically. The only real drawback is the breath is terrible. I mean, it's basically the ketone bodies in your breath, so it smells a bit like rotting pears. Yeah. But apart from that, I'm going to finish, and I want to read one sentence from one of my current favourite writers. The world of the consenting adult, the world remade in accordance with the social contract, is, in the last analysis, a world too timid for love. Rather nice. That's Roger Scruton. In a book called Sexual Desire, a philosophical treatise, I think it's called. He's one of the most elegant writers available at the moment. And what's the title of that book you bought me the other Christmas? Was it A Heretic something? Anyway, it's a lovely little book. You know, some books are nice to hold. That one's beautifully bound, and it's a lovely read. But Roger Scruton is, especially if you've got people who think themselves very clever, they won't match Roger Scruton, and he will make them think. That he'll give you a sentence you can think about all day, just to read it once more. The world of the consenting adult, the world remade in accordance with social contract, is, in the last analysis, a world too timid for love. We didn't get married as consenting adults, did we? We were not too timid for love. Yeah. But the university students today, that's what it's been reduced to. What was even more amazing to me, there was a piece in the First Things by Eberhardt about female professors who go slut marching around the city to pick up a boy at the weekends, dressing as prostitutes, basically. I mean, they're teaching in university, and that's the best they can do. It's amazing.
Confessions of a Heretic.
Confessions of a Heretic, thank you. Lovely little book. One that you can put in your pocket. That's really nice.
Time is up.
Time is up. Oh, summary, yes.
It seems to me that concert of your argument against abortion is to recognize that there are two moral positions which are largely dependent upon your understanding of the truth and
yep.
reality.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And then painting out one of the logical implications if I embody each
yep.
of these moral positions.
Yeah. You can do the abortion approach completely. The implications always work out. What you believe leads to what you ultimately do, particularly your sense of what justice and law should be.
And would the